There's about five, I have a different car.
One of the main reasons is that I've been working in typical remnants off and on for something over 43 years now. So it's something that keep coming back to, things I work on for a while and come back to it again. And I think, well, why do I keep coming back to it? I think the topic of supernova remnants covers a very broad range of interesting astrophysics. So it goes from things late stages of stellar revolution, structure of the interstellar medium, instabilities, particle acceleration, there's the destruction of dust, interaction with molecular clouds. So there's a really very wide range of interesting astrophysical problems there. The other point I think with supernova remnants is we've seen that every time some new development comes and being able to make new observations, that the observations of supernova remnants benefit very much from that. We've seen that recently with some of the ALMA observations of supernova 87A, of course, very nice work being done at GPP and TPP energy for the past 10 years or so. So, there we go. So when I started in the field, the kind of picture was, so this is still a good way of looking at things, these kind of three phases, ejecta-dominated phase, I think about here, non-radium phase, radium shell. Later times, looking at the expansion in the uniform medium, this was developed by Spitzer and Vulture, these are discussed with by other people also. And so in my first paper on remnants, I was working on going into the radiative phase, and let's see. So going from the setup high phase to looking at the shell formation, the shell pop phase along, looking at the temperature, there's a hot gas that was left inside the shell, then it became clear that gas can last a long time before it cools down. So it has this input of hot gas, it also has momentum which is coming from the shell. There's been more attention to that recently now that people are looking at the feedback effects that supernova remnants may have, which is important for the evolution of galaxies. But it's been pretty hard to find good cases of radiative remnants. There's this poster child for our own meeting here at Happy. It's important to see in other meetings also the remnant S147, a large old remnant. And things are roughly consistent with it being a radiative remnant in a interstellar medium with a density of about one or so. But there are other views, and one view is that this, in fact, does fit with the crushed cloud picture. And this crushed cloud picture got started with the key and Ostreicher that what really happens is that supernova remnants expand very rapidly through a low density interstellar medium. And the point is to put together all those hot bubbles left from the supernovae. Remnants in that late phase, the cooling time is long, so you fill a large fraction of the interstellar medium. And that's led to the picture, and there's been further work on this, my paper by Richard White and Knox Long, on this kind of picture where deconduction plays a role in the post-shock region there. And so this has been one of the other pictures, but it's never been completely, I've never seen a really convincing case that this is going on. Look at S147, it's not so clear that there are clouds that are being evaporated there. So that remains one of the outstanding questions that we have still. And I came back to this more recently in the context of looking at remnants like IC443, which is definitely interactive with molecular material that was seen back in the early 1970s by people like Benoyer. And people at first didn't quite know what to make of that, but now it's become clear it does seem to be a supernova remnant that's interacting with a molecular cloud. And this is looking at the radio and the H-alpha emission. Things are very consistent with this emission coming from radio shock fronts, and then the compressed fields and particles here give rise to the radio emission. There's probably some shock acceleration going on there also. And then there's this dark material around here showing there is dark cloud-type stuff which is around there. And it turns out that one can reasonably explain the expansion of most of the remnant, that is this part of the remnant around here, as a radiative remnant expanding into a medium with a density of about 10. And so that's one of the interpretations of this remnant. Then the interesting thing is that there is this region of molecular shock emission, making a little arc around the region here. So, and it turns out that essentially all the molecular emission comes from this one region here. The rest of the retina extends down here, goes up here also. And it turns out that it's just that region where we see the high energy gamma ray emission coming from. And so, what might be going on here? You have to have the star expanding right into the molecular clouds. You don't want the progenitor star to destroy all of the molecular cloud material around it. But you know, for early B star, it won't do that very much, so one might expect to still have the molecular cloud structure. And the old picture for molecular clouds was you had some kind of interclub medium with maybe with a density of about 10, which works out right by 0.443, plus these bumps with density of about 10 to the 3, that a very small part of the acrylic factor is made from dense cores, which become stars. And so then the picture would be that the remnant mainly expands in this uniform medium, becomes radiated to the shell eventually, then hits molecular clumps, and one gets very strong, one gets a very high pressure region where the shell hits the dense clump. That gives rise to some of the molecular emission, plus this would be a good sign for having the gamma ray emission come from. So, one other point of support for this radiative shell is that if one looks at the H1 emission, there is evidence for a shell of H1, which has about the right properties, the right amount of mass, or the kind of radiative shell you'd expect to be built up in a supernova remnant at this late time, something like 30,000 years or so. Okay, getting to the gamma ray observations, certainly very exciting. There's evidence that the high energy gamma rays have a hadronic origin due to this cutoff once he's going for his low energies here. I worked with Xiaoping Tang on this, and he'll be talking in more detail about it later on. But the idea was having the emission come from these where the radiative shell hits the clouds or clumps. And one expects some emission coming from the shell itself, just the radiative shell, plus emission which is coming from where the strong interaction is going on. The other point we had is that we think the TPB gamma rays and the MEB and the GEB gamma rays come from the same region here, and there's a short spectrum which can fit more or less both of them. This is another model by Ushiyama and Lanford et al. Where they don't reproduce the TV emission, which has to be the particular modeling at for the diffusive particle acceleration. Okay, I found this very interesting observation came out recently by Brian Kresge in the Veritas group. This is looking at that region of IC443 again, where the molecular emission is coming from. So the molecular emission is shown from the contours. The interesting thing is that both the latest Fermi emission and the which so one can now this is where that ring of the molecular gas is. So it turns out that both the Fermi, which is here, and the TPB, which is shown over here, one sees the strongest emission where that molecular gas is. So that's number one. Plus the one gets the same kind of picture whether you look at the GEB or the TPB energies here. So it does seem that the TPB PPB are coming from the same place. But some of the early models that were made for IC443, that is certainly not the case. They're assuming that the TPB was coming from another region. So there's that. And also, if one looks at the low contours for the TPB emission, it does seem to fill in this whole region. This is a similar contour going up here. The white is the radio emission. So it does seem to be gamma ray emission, which is coming from the whole remnant here, which is what one would expect also. There's a radiative shell, and plus there's a more intense emission that is coming before the interaction taking place. So this is just looking at near IR, where we can see the emission from the molecular gas coming down here. This is from the J-type shocks, which are up here, the ionizing shocks. And so here we're probably looking at the shockless edge on. Here it looks like there's since the remnant extends down here, it seems to be filaments of molecular gas that the remnant is interacting with. And so there is evidence for filaments in molecular clouds these days. One of the main topics of discussions of molecular clouds. This is looking at the 350 micron dust emission from one cloud that sees these linear features. And it may be that what's happening in IC443 is that the supernova remnants by the rate of phase is interacting with molecular types, with filamentary type structure, which is in the molecular cloud. Okay, so there still is this issue that many people still like the crushed cloud view for these middle-aged remnants, including IC443W44. They are quite different models of what comes up with in the case that with the shock or crushed cloud model, it can be quite young, mostly non-relative shocks versus relative shocks. So I'm sort of on this side here, but I think it still has to be shown whether or not, which is really mostly the most likely model for the kinds of emission that one sees from these middle-aged remnants. Okay, so that's one area that I've spent some time looking at. There's another area I got in fairly around 40 years ago also, which is the Crab Nebula, looking at the pulsar wind nebula and what one expects within an expanded supernova. So in the mid-1970s, it sort of became clear what supernovae were, sort of the explosion, 10 to the 51 Earth, you could go to free expansion, that energy is put in a short period of time. And then over a longer period of time, things like the Crab Nebula, there's power that comes in from the central pulsar, that makes a bubble inside of the expanding ejecta. And since you're expanding into stuff that's already freely expanding, you would accelerate a shell into the ejecta. That's something Raleigh-Taylor instabilities, and presumably that's what gives rise to much of the structure that one sees in the Crab Nebula. So this is the kind of picture one has. There's the shocked pulsar wind here, drives a shell. If one assumes a constant density medium for the ejecta out there, the radius of the shell expands to the 6 power, which means that it's accelerating. So there's this view that one expects, this is what one the result here, but if you allow for multi dimensions, this shell will then break up by Taylor instability. Okay, so one has instabilities. If you look at the center of the graph, it doesn't seem to be that much affected by these Taylor instabilities, and things are really driven by the pulsar that plus one sees this toroidal high field here, which is kind of the archetypal model one has for the Crab-Cornini model that has a purely the particles being affected along the toroidal field flow. And for the central region of the Crab, that seems to work quite well. People have worked out the detailed model. There will be some presentations here on that. If you allow for the asymmetric power input coming from the pulsar, that one can end up with structures that look very much like this. But if you look at the larger scale for the Crab, this is in the infrared, there's the region of toroidal field is in this region right here. But if you look over much of the volume of the Crab, it turns out these are more chaotic, and that structure is probably the result of these Raleigh-Taylor instabilities which are going on there. Another remnant, 2C58, that also shows some evidence for a toroidal type structure here, that's coming out. But on the larger scale, things are really quite chaotic again. And one point that was made by Steve Reynolds, Pat Slane, also in the paper on 2C58, one looks at the X-ray photon index as a function of radius. Things like the Kellen-Cornini model with this effective flow of the toroidal field. It turns out that one expects a very sharp change in the photon index of one particular radius, which is not what you see. So to get the kind of spread out effect of the change in the spectral index, it's very good to have the diffusion of the particles, which might be possible if you have a situation where you have a much more chaotic field than just a toroidal one, which is predicted in the Helen and Cornini model. So again, with Xiaoping Tang, we looked at models with advection plus diffusion and found in those models, because you're mixing the particles in radii, you can in fact spread out the change of the spectral index. So things look out, end up looking more or less like what you observe. You're just where this is looking at the spectrolytic function of the radius. So this, the steepening of the spectrum that one has, what one's talking about here is due to synchrotron radiation. For the crab, one sees a similar thing, but where this applies to the optical and IR because of the stronger magnetic field that the crab has. So this again goes against sort of a pure toroidal model, but because of the polyphasal instabilities that one has, one can expect that that will break up the kind of pure toroidal structure that one might otherwise have. So John, most recently, John London and I have been trying to do more on figuring out how these polyphasal instabilities work. There can also be some work done by Ford in this area. And so the beginning part is just looking at a pulsar wind epidemic with steady input coming from the pulsar. And this is assuming that the external ejecta has a constant density here. This is the shell, which is swept up here. And if one lets this go long enough, one gets the instability and eventually reaches a saturated point where, of course, the instabilities develop with time, but the basic structure, the overall structure, stays more or less the same. So that's what's happening. So wind comes from the pulsar here, it's a shock wind, shock pulsar wind, which is in this region here, and then these filaments which come in from the swept up shell. And in this case, there's about an equal amount of mass in the shell at this point as there is in the interior filaments here. So this is looking at the first couple of times, this is looking couple more times, so this is expanding by more than a factor of 10 in time, just much more than a factor of 10 in radius. And so one sees this sort of churning away of the instability. At least during this early phase, it stays always more or less the same. The appearance of the instability, the polyphasal instability here, is in fact very much like the instabilities that we have found. We're looking at slowing down supernovae ejecta with some certain stellar gas here. So this is some older work. It's kind of more or less the inside-out version of what happens for the pulsar wind nebula case. In this case here, there's dense gas, which is the stellar ejecta here, which is being slowed down by the low-density gas, which is through the certain stellar medium there. And so that's opposed to the pulsar wind nebula case, where one has the low-density gas, which is accelerating the dense gas. One again gets the instability, but occurring the other way around. So the next thing you want to look at is what happens if you keep the pulsar going and this shell eventually gets to the steep part of the supernova density profile here. In this kind of case here, the density drop is R to minus 7. I can show from simple arguments that if you have if you consider what happens to the shell, if some of the shell material drops back because of the instability, the ram pressure of the material which is out ahead of the shell can sort of contain the hot gas which is in the interior if you're in this case here. But once you get to the case where the density drops quickly with the radius, then the material starts to escape through the shell. What's outside the shell is not able to stop the expansion. So one can expect something like a blowout from the pulsar wind nebula. So we've been looking at cases like that. The top case here is just looking at the case where the bubble continues to expand into a constant density medium. But the case down here, looking at the same kinds of times, is where it's gone into the region where the density drops rapidly with the radius. And as one can see, the hot gas is able to sort of push through the swept up materials, and one is left with much of the mass which is towards the inside, with the low density shock pulsar wind able to sort of escape through the shell here. So, this is something that could happen for the remnants that we know about, the sort of pulsar wind nebula that we know about. It seems that the initial period that the pulsar sand is not fast enough to be able to get to this kind of phase. This is looking at sort of a full 2 pi here. This is again. In two-dimensional simulation, it turns out if you go to three dimensions, that things are a bit different. So, as often happens with instabilities, if you look at 2D, what happens if there's sort of an overemphasis of the low order modes, as one sees here, And if one goes to three dimensions, that's not so accentuated. There's still the fact, though, that the sort of low-density shocked pulsar wind does kind of escape through the shell, sort of the ejecta that's towards the center here. So the approximate condition for the blowout to occur is that the positive pulsar spin down energy be greater than the supernova energy ESN there. So the thing is, you have to be putting at least as much energy in from the pulsar that you had with the expanding gas to begin with to enable this shock pulsar wind to be able to escape through the swept up shell. So there's a couple of cases where that may occur. So if you have a normal supernova, you need to have a very energetic pulsar. Where that's been proposed recently is in models for superluminous supernovae involving magnetars. And in order to get the kind of light emission that one sees from those objects, one needs to have an initial spin rate corresponding to an energy of something like 10 to the 52 Earths. And that energy has to come in a relatively short period of time, something like 5 days or three to 8 days or so. So this could be important there for people who have been modeling including magnetar models for the supernova events. Don't assume that this is occurring. If you had some of that shock pulsar power sort of escape through in this particular model, here's some people who have been using the same kinds of ideas about making a bubble within the supernova. But in that case, most of the energy goes into thermal energy, which is optically thick radiation. So if this instability occurs, some of that radiation will be able to escape and also lose its energy. So one might expect a drop in the luminosity that one gets from the supernova's event. The other case would be if the supernova energy is lower, something like 10 to 50 Earths. We do know that some supernovae do have this low energy, that the period can be 3 times higher, plus a factor of 10, square root of 10 higher. And now we're going back to the crab again, and I think one can make an argument that the crab is a low energy event. So if it were a normal 10 to 51 Earth event, one would expect to see external signs. It's something that kind of ongoing discussions Ron Pease about. And in fact, there doesn't seem to be anything out there that we see. We don't see the interacting surrounding medium there. We don't see the extended some absorption to the extended part of the supernova ejecta, which has not been shocked yet. That remains a problem, I think, but it may help a bit if the supernova was a low energy one, so there's really not that much stuff out there. And if one looks at the constraints on the craft, the abundances that one sees there suggest something like an 8-10 solar mass progenitor star. One looks at the various characteristics, particularly there's quite a bit of mass which is within the nebula compared to the mass that one started out with here. So that seems to mean that, in fact, the crab remnant has, in fact, run into most of the mass that the star has. The velocity is quite low there, so that means that the energy that the explosion had was in fact, quite low. So in a recent paper with Yang here, Haifeng Yang, we made the argument that there is, things aren't most consistent with the low energy supernova, one can fit this like acceleration of the mass cooling shock that seems to be there. And so that may also have something, so if you have a low energy supernova for the crab, one may also be able to get this peculiar jet perseid by Sibbie Vandenberg. Ted Dole and I looked at this in the mid-1970s, you can't see it that well, there was this faint, maybe O3, this sort of what's called the crab jet going up here. So this doesn't really look like the kind of things we were getting from the simulations. I mean, the simulations about the magnetic, but the magnetic field could be playing some role. And perhaps one has structure which is within the ejecta that's out here. But if the crab is a low energy event, then it might be getting to the point where the pulsar wind nebula is being able to break out of the shell, and that might, this could be a manifestation of that. Okay, I think I'm almost done here. So I'm just saying, after more than 40 years now, sort of working various parts of supernova remnants, there are many mysteries still persist, and new ones have come along, and I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your taking this note. I have a question about the situation of dropping at all. Could you mention about the electricity tariff?
The does it work by group?
Yeah, Rodney, John Rodney. He showed the RPD a high oscillation parasitic interaction. And there is not a Newtonian situation for special electricity situation. And even if the special electricity situation and operate the particle factor of the parasol beam cannot be treated overall by the numerical simulation. So could you mention about the electricity effect?
If you understand the name, I've had trouble interpreting. What we assume there, that's just assuming that the pulsar wind nebula acts like a gas equals 4/3 being a bad gas. So it's not trying to look at the details of the, the pulsar wind and the characteristics that that has. So it's just assuming that it acts like a low density gas equals 4/3 gas and doesn't do the MHD and all of that. Yeah, so it should be done better. There is work by Corin et al. They do the and so there is so that does more details for the shock pulsar. We're just trying to get some idea of how the instabilities work.
Any more questions?
You said that the Crab Nebula with its low energy can spread the back of the shell and that can be applied more easily to these nuclear gates, which I think is a thought to be a low energy project, because that's got good constraints on the back of any outer shell.
Yeah, since 3C50A is kind of a puzzling object, you see it's kind of, with the radio, you see this extended vision, going across the remnant. I'm not sure whether our model can explain that particularly well. Again, so if you go to the 3D phase, you don't get a sort of large scale structure like what we've seen 3C50A. But yeah, but that is another case where you don't see any emission around it. There is evidence in that case for shock superstellar tensor if you don't have the crack. So there are those two that are on, and there are quite a few pulse with it. Nebula where you do see the shock around it, you can see the subset emission around it, that things seem to be consistent at the standard model. So they're not all the pulse with it nebula show the same thing as part of the moment of the supernova.
Any more questions? Here we have one more question here.
So I guess I'm trying to formulate my question. The objects like the Cygnus Loop, which has a non-radiator shock on the outside edge, but it still has a very bright radiator shell, would seem to be someplace in between the nice steps in the model of the expanding, values and the radiator and so forth.
Yeah.
Reality, I guess, is just more complicated than their simple status models or whatever. But what would you call the superstructure? Is it a radiator remnant?
Yeah, it shows characteristics of both. I mean, that's true for the Vela remnant, too, which I showed on my first slide. So it shows there are some areas up there which will not be in the shocks also. And see, it seems to sort of the Vela remnant seems to be made a transition maybe from case. Things like the Cygnus Loop, I would look at that in detail. People would look at it more like it interacting with a shell that was made from a progenitor star, so we have created some kind of a wind bubble around that the supernova had expanded into. And I guess if that shell is maybe not complete, or the supernova shock has broken through in some places and got to a lower density medium, which is on the other side. That's a possibility, yeah. But the actual cases do come out to be quite complex, and so it's hard to apply to very simple models.
Any more questions?
and it's just a little wonderful. The crab is such an exceptional object, and yet we can't treat it as a prototype. And I wonder if you had any comments about, you know, is this a normal object, is this an extreme object, something that we just can observe very well, but it's not really a prototype?
Yeah, well, I think if you look, I mean, the initial rotation rate for the crab was in fact quite fast compared to normal neutron stars. So people have done studies of rotation rates of pulsars looking at the population of pulsars, find that the typical initial rotation rate is sort of like at least 100 milliseconds or so. For the crab, it's estimated to be 19. So the power that one gets in the case of the crab seems to be very high compared to what one gets for most pulsars. So it is the energetic, you know, mostly, you know, so what we can see the best is sort of the brightest, but in many ways that makes it did make it the best one to study also. But you know, one doesn't have to worry that the more powerful pulsar like this will have some strange things that others don't. But anyway.
You know, we have one more.
Still talk about the crab. Suggestion that it was a superluminous or a superluminous event has been made for a long time. But what about the historical evidence for that? Was the supernova brightness similar to a normal supernova, or was it maybe superluminous?
Okay, so one thing I was talking about the superluminous, I was talking about these newly found events, which are very far away, these superluminous, which are like a bit more than 10 to 44 Earths per second. And there would be something special, a magnetar, to be able to power them. So that's sort of center point from the crab. For the crab, it was fairly bright, so absolute magnitude about minus 18 or so, but not, whereas the superluminous things are like minus 22. So the crab is minus 18, which is fairly bright. One could probably do that with the explosion of a fairly extended star, so that one could get that kind of brightness. There was a model that Nathan Smith had where he was getting that brightness from interacting with the surrounding medium. I think that's a bit less likely. So it was presumably a type 2 because it had the hydrogen, but it was sort of low energy, you know, maybe low energy, we don't know. It was in fact fairly bright, which makes it different from some of the type 2 supernovae, which have low energy, which are also tended to be faint, but that may be related to the radius of the progenitor star.
Okay, if there's no more questions, I'll thank Roger again, and you're welcome.